So this is Bernadette Sweeney recording an interview with Galen Calvert on November 17th, 2010. Recording an interview for The Gathering, Collected Oral Histories of the Irish in Montana. And we are at 301 West Front Street, Missoula. Galen, thanks so much for agreeing to be interviewed this morning.
Sure.
First of all, I want to ask you what you can tell us about your Irish background, your Irish heritage.
Okay, what I know personally is from a cousin of mine who is LDS, and of course she's done a great study of the ancestry, and so I know a little bit more about it than I would otherwise. Then I also was down in, got all right there?
Yeah, that's fine.
I happen to work in Washington, D.C., for several years, and I was raised to believe that that my family wanted us to be descendants of the Lords of Baltimore.
Right.
And so when I went down there and studied that, we are not descendants of the Lords of Baltimore. It might be the other way around, but anyway.
Right.
My immigrant ancestor was a John Calvert, which I have here, born there in County Armagh, Ireland in 1731. And he came over to this country with a number of children, both boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
And the oldest one, another John, inherited the property at, I think it's called now Virgil, New York. And what was their properties all around that area have sort of consolidated or been sold or whatever, but
right.
But it still are was in the family for a while. And my particular ancestor Nathaniel was a teenager born in Ireland in 1781, but he came with his dad over to this country, I believe in 1793, and they came into New York Harbor, went up the Hudson River, and then west over to this Virgil, New York area.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were he married and from an Elizabeth, it's on this list, an Elizabeth,
yeah.
Betsy Campbell. Am I going into too much detail or anything?
Not at all, you're doing great.
Okay, so he married a Elizabeth Betsy Campbell, who happened to have been born in the United States. And from that union came William Nathaniel Calvert, who was my great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, William Nathaniel Calvert was a blacksmith, I think in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, when Colonel Drake drilled his first well at Titusville.
Right.
He drilled the well in southeast Titusville, and Nathaniel decided that was a good deal, so he went and drilled a well in the north. I'm sorry, Drake's was southwest Titusville, PA, and my ancestor, William Nathaniel, went over and drilled a well in northeast Titusville area, which at the time they called Fagundes. And as a boy, I used to hunt with my dad and my uncles. on that property, which used to have been my great grandfather's property, along with the wells. And interesting, you have a picture there of wells on your stuff.
Yes.
They just were. You could walk. You could step from one to another. There were. They just were all over the place.
Yeah.
And so he had his, and then he built a. a manor house down on the Allegheny River there, where my grandfather, Eugene James Calvert, his son was brought up to be a landed gentry to play the piano and dance and so forth.
Right.
And so he didn't know what to do. But my great grandfather lost the whole thing. He sold out.
Oh.
And so he sold out, and so in the 1860 census he was a wealthy oil man, and in the 1870 census he was a laborer.
Oh.
down in a different county, and that's where my dad, Cecil Eugene Calvert here,
yeah,
was born in Shakora, Pennsylvania in 1886. And by this time his dad had become a gauger, where he went out and gauged the oil tanks where the individual wells would they'd put the oil in the tank, and then they'd gauge it.
Uh-huh.
And the gauge would tell how much then was emptied out of the tank, and
yeah. Yeah.
And so that's how they decided who got paid what. And they sent the information by telegraph, which was the only way that you could communicate in those days.
Yes.
So my dad became a telegrapher at a very early time, and went on to be the chief telegrapher for Buckeye Pipeline out in Ohio. And I learned that business, to be a telegrapher, from a child, you know, a Boy Scout, my dad, and so on. So that got me into that line of duty in the Navy years later.
Oh, I see. You had that skill.
So anyway, Dad, my mother were married, in Ohio, and I was born in Lima, then Lima, Ohio. And
you were born in
1927. He had a chance during the Depression. It was pretty serious, and we all know about the Depression, but my dad his father had retired in Oil City, and was friends with the president of National Transit Pipeline Company. I guess when he got promoted to be president, he wanted a private secretary. In those days, you didn't have all this electronic stuff, so the way you communicated was with dictating to a private secretary. And so my dad had taken studied to be a doctor, and didn't quite. He was an eighth grade education. He went on to study medicine in Cleveland, but he also was a new Greg shorthand, as well as being a telegrapher.
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, he became the private secretary to the president of National Transit Pipeline Company, and then during the Depression, shorthanded and all that, when he wasn't doing that work, he handled the payroll and so forth for National Transit. So I grew up in Oil City during the Depression, and I don't think my dad ever got a raise from 1927 till World War II, but we were better off than most people are. The people next door didn't have cars. They'd go to a local grocery store and bring their groceries home in a wagon, a little kid's wagon, and no cars. People going hungry.
And how many were in your family, Galen?
My mother had been married before, and she had two older daughters, Jean and Eileen. They're about 6 and 7 years older than I was.
Yes.
And so I was raised sort of with them.
Yes.
And my folks put me in school when I was 5, and not kindergarten, I mean first grade.
Oh.
So when you fast forward to World War II, my buddies were all a year older than I was, but they waited for me to get to be 17.
Right.
So about April 2nd, 1944, I was 17, so we all went to Pittsburgh and joined the Navy, which was the only branch of service that would take 17-year-olds at the time.
Yeah.
So we all joined together, but as luck would have it, they I got called. As I say, look, I got called right away.
Yeah.
And so my service was completely different than theirs. They went to the, when they went up, one went in the Naval Air. He stayed in school, he had to stay in school till he physically graduated to be in the Naval Air Service.
Yes.
And he washed out by crashing a steerman trainer, and that took him out of that. The other fellows went to the Admiralty Islands, which were down somewhere between the Solomons and Australia, and were sort of the backwater of things going on, where they repaired ships and sort of supplied place, did supply work and that, but they were out of it. I interesting to me, of actually washed out of Aviation Radio Gunner School in Jacksonville, Florida, because of my health. I was hospitalized for 3 weeks, and the war was really winding down, and to make a long story short, they put me in the Naval Amphibious Forces.
Right.
So I served in, I started out in aviation, went in the amphibious forces, and as such, trained as a Marine, which I hadn't exactly volunteered to do.
Right, yeah.
God bless them, you know.
And did you do any active service?
Yeah, so I Googled myself recently, and I find that it shows right on Google where I was a passenger on APA 124, which was an attack transport that happened to be the sister ship of the Missoula, the APA Missoula.
Oh.
And there's a beautiful model of the Missoula out here in the library.
Yes.
I mean in the out of Fort Missoula in the military museum out there. So that, and we, the APA, the LaGrange and the Missoula were sister ships in the Battle of Okinawa, and somehow or another, I guess I'd have been a good shot when I was a kid with grouse and quail in Pennsylvania, so they gave me an expert rifleman a medal. I don't ever remember shooting a rifle.
Oh, really?
But I was a killer with this skeet and trap.
Right.
So when I got on this, believe it or not, it's hard for me to believe, when I got on the LaGrange, I think they'd sent their good guys over to Okinawa already, because the kamikazes were really, they were winning.
Yeah.
They did some real damage over there. So the skilled guys had gone over there, so they were short-handed, and they put me on this anti-aircraft gun. So I served on that, shooting at kamikazes there at Okinawa, and then I went on the beach and got in a little bit of action with the Seabees there, and so I. It's construction battalion. Usually, it's older men who built stuff. But what happened on Okinawa, the Marines would just drive and push the, you know, kill and push the Japanese back. And if they would come into a real well-defended cave, they would just mark that for the Seabees to take care of. And they would go on. Well, then they'd leave these caves, these hillsides all hollowed out, and leave it to the Seabees to go in there with Bangalore torpedoes and a phosphorus grenades and stuff and get them out of there. Well, I, lacking sense, I joined one of these operations and got damaged sufficiently, so I have a 50% disability now. For I never got wounded. I was, God was really good to me, because I had hand grenades go off within a foot of my head, and I had four hand grenades go off within a foot of me, two right by my head when I was laying in the mud, and they went off, and the mud flew, but got no scratches, but it damaged my ear, and a couple other times there. So between the 5-inch 38 and the aircraft gun and the hand grenades, totally dead.
So it took out the hearing in one ear?
Yeah, this ear, people think they can talk. They see the hearing aid here, so they try talking this.
Right.
And the reason there's nothing there, there's nothing to...
Oh, nothing to amplify?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that was kind of long-winded answer to your first question.
Let me take it back a little bit, all the way back, to John Calvert, your ancestor, who was born in Armagh in 1731.
Yes.
Do you know where in County Armagh?
My cousin talks about County Antrim also.
Right.
And there was something going on. Like he may have lived in Antrim after he was born in Armagh.
Right, yeah. Well, they're bordering counties.
Yeah, right, right.
By Montana standards, yeah, they're small distances.
I don't know how many you'll find along this line, but we were Orangemen, you know. With
yes.
Not everybody.
Yeah. Well, with a name like Calvert.
Yeah, well, it was a lot, probably a lot, most of them were probably not Orangemen.
Yeah.
I have a daughter that married a German fellow, but of the right faith,
right,
so
well,
to speak.
There are all kinds of Irishness. So
yeah,
we're more than happy to welcome all comers.
Okay, well, thank you. So I don't know more about him than I did follow some of the other older brothers. There's more than one older brother came down into the Jamestown, Pennsylvania area there with Nathaniel. But then they married and went on and did their own thing. I know there's some still around, because I'm getting a few emails from people that want to talk about same thing you want to talk about, but I don't know. Except my own branch.
Own research. And you mentioned earlier that John Calvert was in his 50s when he emigrated from Ireland.
I think he would have been, yeah. If born in 1731, he came over and he came over.
They came to the United States in 1804.
In 1793. So 31 from 93 is.
So that would have been. What about 62?
Maybe 62, and his there's no record of his wife, probably deceased. He came with his children, not his wife.
Right. So his adult children emigrated, and he came with them.
Right.
My goodness, that's a very untypical
Yeah.
It's very much a departure from the pattern of emigration that we're
I suppose
we're seeing through this project.
Yeah, it's kind of unique, I guess.
It really is. And I also wanted to ask you a question about your grandfather. You said he was brought up in a well-to-do in well-to-do circumstances.
Well enough to do, you know. I think he could be looked up in the 1860 census. He and a fellow by the name, I think, Gilchrist,
mm-hmm.
were partners in this well, and they were worth several thousand dollars in those days, which was like a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm sure. And when you say well, you mean oil well?
Yeah, in an oil well, yeah. A producing well at Fagundes, which is now just north of Pleasantville. And my still living cousin, who would be an Irish immigrant,
yeah.
he's still living. He was the postmaster for his whole career in Pleasantville. You might want to write that. His name is Chester.
Chester.
He's still alive as far as I know. He's 7 years older than I am, so it'd be make him about 90. And he lives in Maryland, I believe. I probably have his phone number, but I don't have his address.
So you were born, as you mentioned earlier, in 1927. And where exactly were you born in Pennsylvania?
In Lima, Ohio.
Right. And your as part of your childhood or your identity growing up, was there much of an emphasis on your Irish background? Did you know much about your Irish background? Was it part of your upbringing, do you think?
No, as I say, my uncles all wanted us to be descendants of the Lords of Baltimore, and we did come together in Venango County, Pennsylvania, but from my research, I found that somebody had to be married after he was dead, married after he was dead to make that connection.
Right.
So I've told some of my relatives about this, and they don't want to hear it.
Right, so you're disproving the family.
Yeah, there is an interesting thing. Well, I don't know how interesting it will be to you because it went somewhere else from Montana and all that. But my grandfather's brother, Eugene James Calvert's brother, went to Pittsburgh and married a Seventh-day Adventist lady,
mm-hmm.
became a doctor, and I found him being the head of the great Seventh-day Adventist missionary medical effort all over the world. He was heading that up. And so his son, my dad's first cousin, went under his father's auspices to China, and after some things that happened over there, he ended up being a warlord over there became the ambassador with the Chiang Kai-shek government to Italy, to Mussolini.
Oh.
So my dad's first cousin went to Mussolini's Italy as the entourage of the ambassador. And so his two daughters were raised with Mussolini's kids, and they're the ones that I talk I talked to them. I knew. I talked once to the fella who had been the in the entourage of the ambassador to Mussolini before he died, and his daughters are maybe still be alive, but they don't. We don't communicate because they want to be. They want to be descendants of the lords. But anyway, when Hitler and Mussolini got tight, this fella Reed Calvert, my
father's first cousin.
My father's cousin came back to the States and started a clinic in Maryland there, which has now been absorbed into this big medical complex that the Adventists have. So.
Interesting family.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier as well, you discovered a cousin after 35 years of.
Yeah, his name is David Diffenderfer, and he grew up in like Sharon, which was maybe 35 miles from Oil City,
mm-hmm.
and I just haven't figured out my LDS cousin knows, but he's something like my great grandfather is brother and sister to his great grandmother. There's another great in there because he's like a dinner. He's a 10 years younger than I am.
Right.
So anyway, we're in touch now. He lives down in California, and and email him back and forth.
So tell me about your education.
Well, thank the Lord and the VA. I graduated from Penn State University and majored in clinical psychology, did graduate work in clinical psychology, and our first child, who now lives here in Missoula, that came along in the Korean War, and I just never did finish my thesis. I did everything but my thesis then at Penn State, and so my avocation or my vocation was in labor management relations for major companies like RCA, Sylvania, General Telephone and Electronics, British Petroleum, and that was my vocation. My avocation was flying. I loved to fly. I took my muster now pay from the Navy, got a pilot's license, and so when I'm working for British Petroleum in Alaska, I was also with the Alaska Civil Air Patrol, and went out on searches and actually found some people, you know.
Yeah.
And then that went on for a number of years, but in 1971, I became what's ordinarily called the Christian born again on January 1st, 1967. I was 39 years old. And 1 year to the, almost to the day after that, I'm doing my thing as a labor relations guy for RCA, I'm sorry, British Petroleum at that time. And I started getting inventive ideas. And it's been the bane of my existence ever since, so, because they are 40 years ahead of their time. I'll give you the paperwork here to show you that.
Yeah.
And after several years, anyway, about 2002, I saw that where this whole energy thing was going.
Yes.
So I switched over to energy, and was already incorporated, so I changed the name of the company to Energy Technology Innovation Incorporated. And am incorporated, have stock for sale, so forth and so on. And everybody wants to need to qualify to be given money. I mean, given loans. I don't want their money. I want them to listen to me.
Yeah.
And I've been to Dr. Rudbach when he was alive. God bless him. He sent me to Montana State University. Talked to those people. I've talked to these people out here on Broadway, you know, in that building down there. There's a fellow out there. I tried to find a letter I wrote to him.
Uh-huh.
And I it's just a desire in my heart to get a hearing, a fair hearing.
Yes.
Basically, no one has discredited me, but they're always busy with what they're doing right then. I have letters from testers saying they have my stuff before Congress, but I've been across the street to see his office over here. They're tired of seeing me.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all nice people and so on, but it's just been that for years. I'd like to show you just where some of it goes. If I don't know if it'll show. Where's my stuff? Is it here?
That's your stuff there, isn't it? Yes, it is.
It's this one here.
Yes.
Or no, maybe it's in that one there.
No,
that's yours,
one.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know if this will show up, but how far back this goes. And this is just by way of an example. This is back when we, the big thing was aerodynamics.
So when you say you switched from aerodynamics to energy.
Yes.
In the early 2000s.
And you see that the date of this was June 26, 2003.
Right.
And this is me. And this is showing what the invention of mine back in I got a patent on this in 1971.
Yes.
On this.
Uh-huh.
And then Northrop Grumman, after my patent ran out in 88, Northrop Grumman repatented it, and as they called it the Flying Swiss Army Knife. But if you look at their drawings, and I have them right here,
mm-hmm.
and mine, it's the same thing.
So what is this, Caleb?
In layman's terms, it was a better way. The then flying F-111.
Right.
It was a better F-111 than flying.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to tell them, don't do it that way. You're on the right, you're heading in the right direction with the F-111, but this is better.
Right.
That was in 71.
So this was a design for a wing?
Yeah, it's the wing design. What happens is, aerodynamically, in layman's terms, a slow flight wing wants to be fat in the front. It's fat in the front and thin trailing edge.
Yes.
And a supersonic wing, you want it to be thin in the front and then deal with the trailing edge however you need to, and there's ways of doing it. There's a Boeing engineer by the name of Tulinius knows how to do all that. But anyway, what I did was start out with the wing like this to begin with,
mm-hmm.
which was for slow flight, and it's fat front, skinny back.
Yes.
But then it came around like this, 90 degrees. The fat part got hid in the slot along the side of the fuselage, so it's out of the airstream. And then what you then are dealing with is the former trailing edge, which is thin.
Yes.
Perfect for supersonic.
Yes.
That's it.
So your patent
patent.
Sorry, yes, my Irish accent. Your patent was from 1971.
Yes.
And was that patent used during that period until 1988?
No, I flew in my own airplane. There's a picture of the airplane over there on the up there that I flew from Anchorage, from Fairbanks or Anchorage, Alaska, to meet the then head of what's now NASA. His name is inscribed in stone in the patent office. He's America's premier aerodynamic engineer. His name is Richard T. Whitcomb.
Mm-hmm.
I spent an afternoon with him, like I'm spending this wonderful time with you. He said, nothing wrong with what you're talking about, but, you know, we're already involved with and so forth and so on. I flew on to Florida to see the second greatest American aerodynamicist by the name of Fred Weick.
Yes.
He was now 80 some years old working for Piper. And after an afternoon with him, he said, Galen, what you're trying to do is make things better. We're trying to make them cheaper. That's the Piper answer. And it's been like that for forever.
Yeah. So what happened when the other company took over the patent in 1988? Or?
Well, then they made one at taxpayer expense.
Yes.
But the F-111 has been retired now for about 20 years probably, so I mean, you know, it's an answer to nothing.
Yeah.
So they didn't fund it. It was not funded. They named it the Switchblade.
Yeah.
Or the Flying Swiss Army Knife.
And what did you have a name for yours?
Mine was called Cristo Dado, Spanish for Christ Given, because he started giving me these ideas. I had this why me thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why me? But why not me? It's got to be somebody.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a true story.
So you switched in 2003?
About 2002, 2003. I have all the stuff to show you where I started out with some nice people around here. It's still going. It's right here in town. They have people working here, and it has to do with helping people get ideas into practice. And I went with them, followed them around for a couple, 3 years. And when it got right down to cases where I had something that they agreed they needed, and I had, it required my company to have an accounting system that was government approved. Mm-hmm. That disabled lady in there is my accounting system.
Yes.
So. That all fell apart on that.
Yeah.
And then I've talked to the people at the state. This just goes on and on. So I don't know if you want to go there, but I do have now this thing here do you have any, do you have more questions on that?
Well, tell us about this picture here on the wall.
Okay, energy. And I want to, the stuff here for you to read.
Thank
but the energy is a constant in the universe, and particularly in this solar system, except for a few meteor strikes from outer space, which is awful hard to quantify and use.
Yes.
It's all from the sun. It's all from the sun, and it does not diminish. There's no change according to Einstein's theory of relativity and all that. And it's huge. It's the mass of the Earth, times energy, the speed of light squared. So it's a great amount of energy. And so an important, and all work in the world from the empowerment of this conversation to what's happening out there on the highways, there is it's not lost, but there's only two things you can do with energy. It produces all work in the world. That's where I started with that.
Yeah.
And you can either conserve it, or you can convert it. Now, big business wants to convert it because they are involved and they get paid well for conversion of it. If you were to, but equally, I say equally important, if not more important, is the conservation of it.
Yes.
Now this thing here is a rather expensive painting I had done, and if you look at those lines, the yellow, the white, and the red lines,
in the mountains,
if what you have there is, let's say this is a pass between Montana
mm-hmm.
and Washington there, or what's the next state over there,
Idaho,
or anyway, you have to do that travel. Now, if you go over there on the 7% grade, which is the maximum grade in this country, I don't think it is in Europe, it takes like 5 miles of going back and forth, the one line there, that's actually to scale. If you had a string, we actually used a string and had a string representing the red line and the white line.
Right.
And it's over 5 miles of travel to get over that thing using a 7% grade.
So sorry, this is an ignorant question, but what do you mean by the 7% grade?
It's the highway grade that is now allowed in the United States.
Right.
Like this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like this.
Steeper than that.
Right. Now, if you went to the 10.5 grade, in other words, 50% more.
Yes.
You save the 33% of the energy involved with the travel forever after.
Right.
Forever after.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the same, it's the same amount of energy to accomplish the 2,000, that's a 2,000 foot thing there.
Yeah.
Here's the highway coming in here, and then it's going over that, well, you don't need to go, but that up there at the corner,
mm-hmm.
it's going over there.
Yes.
On the two different grades.
Yes.
And of course, you can't do the 3D thing. In practice, they have to go around the hills and so on. Of course,
right.
You can only draw it on one side of the hills. But
yeah.
But basically, we use the string, the white and the other string, and the difference is about, instead of 5 miles something, it's 3 miles.
Yes, I understand.
So the difference is 33% forever.
My goodness.
Now, that's only illustrative of all sorts of things like that. I use a couple of words that are kind of used differently. One of them is synergism.
Yes.
Synergism is that which it's the energy that it takes to release or allow another energy to do its thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I work for BP in Alaska. They know a lot of the things that's going on in the world right now is that the synergistic energy, that which is needed to release the other energy, is more. It's more. Now it's good for the natives. It was good for me in Anchorage. It's good for my son-in-law working up there. Grandson is working up there. It's good for the local economy,
yeah.
But it's a world negative. It's a world energy negative. Everything's talking about green,
mm-hmm.
green. We are destroying the world by using more energy to do work than taking it out of the world's energy supply. Well, say fossil fuels. We're using more fossil fuels to produce fossil fuels than we're getting. Or, of course, this whole thing with ethanol. I mean, to take ethanol, which is basically the corn one, to destroy the world's food supply, to make gasoline, to make ethanol, which is lower octane than the gasoline to begin with.
Yeah.
So it's all of that sort of thing.
One of the other things you mentioned on the phone, in our phone conversation, was using human-produced
energy. Chemical,
yes.
Yeah, I have that now. Right now I'm in touch with, well, I'm in touch with you, which I thank you for being there. But there's some other people that there may be a breakthrough on this thing that I have of using human chemical energy to release gravity power to make electricity.
Okay.
What's happening now in these countries over there? They're riding bicycles. They're doing the treadmill or pushing the things around in a circle. You know,
even
at Penn State, they're going on right now at Penn State. There's a Navy contract there that, well, at least it was a year ago, a Navy contract to work with Penn State to come up with devices that Marines could carry with them that would, from their body movements, produce electric power for the equipment they're carrying.
Hmm.
They're taking that right out of the guy's hide. You're taking that right out of how many miles he's going to be able to walk with that. That's totally wrong. At MIT and there's and up there now, I read about, they're talking about taking the energy, the recoil action of a shock absorber on vehicles and turning that into electricity. They already have alternators.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. What needs to be done is to get with this, using human chemical energy as the synergistic thing to release gravity. Every pound, look out there. Now, out there at those mountains in Bangladesh, they don't have any. So the British have gone in there and said, "Hey, we'll help you with your energy problem. We'll go out in the ocean and we'll put some buoys out there and we'll have the wave action and all this and going on and all that, and we'll make some electricity from that, or the wave action or the tidal action."
Mm-hmm.
They talk about that's all gravity. The water is just a medium for the gravitational pull in there, see? God gave Western Montana every pound of every pound above, well, say where the traffic going there, every pound of that out there is potential, has potential energy in it. I know how to put, and I've tried to get in touch with the mayor, I've talked to the guy out here, like I say, down the road there. And people just don't get back to me on this stuff. But if they would, we could put I wanted to put the Smurfit Stone plant to work out there with a show and tell model of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Like a picture's worth a thousand words, a show and tell thing of what I could get designed for and produced for, I don't know, maybe $10,000. They could see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it could be used in the developing nations where they need a tenth or less of electric power. They'd be happy with a tenth or less of what we use here.
Yes.
My idea is pretty labor intensive.
Yeah.
And but it could put people to work regardless of their IQ or whatever. If they could walk and take nourishment,
yeah,
they could convert the chemical energy of their last meal after they've had enough to supply their daily needs, convert it to electricity.
My goodness.
So.
And you have patents on these ideas?
The next thing I need to do, and I'm that's what I'm doing when I'm not, like, I would be doing it now, would be working on what you call a preliminary application for patent.
Uh-huh.
I did that with, this will explain, I did that with one. A fella came over in a $40,000 Toyota from Idaho, and I explained this all to him. I put him up in the Symes Hotel out in Hot Springs while I explained it to him, and the next thing I know, he was peddling it in Florida to a guy I happened to know.
Oh.
who squealed on him. So what I did was simply make a better one.
Right.
So he can have that one. I know how to do it better already.
And how long does the patent process take?
The process right now to get the patent is probably 4 years.
Oh.
But the patent, preliminary patent application gives you rights there and is a certain amount of protection.
Yes, yes.
What ought to happen really in the business world is for Missoula, Montana to be firstest with the mostest and keep on going with it, you know.
Yeah.
Because somebody else will copy it and do it anyway, probably, but.
Yeah. Extraordinary. So how many patents or patents in process do you have right now?
Well, over the years I've had maybe a dozen. I don't have any, but this one I'm talking to you about right now. I have some, you know, some laying around here somewhere that I did get.
Yeah.
You heard about the Al Gore argument that he invented the internet. Did you hear that?
That's a nod of assent from videographer Patrick Cook.
Let me show you something. See that? You see a little picture right there underneath that?
This here?
Yeah, let me show you this.
Are you rolling here, Patrick?
Okay,
let's just wait one moment.
Okay. Are we offline right now?
We are.
I'm just waiting for him to load back up. Rolling up. Let me.
Okay.
Can we record this?
Yeah, this
This
is a kind of a funny, you know, Al Gore invented the internet.
Yeah.
Well, that's my very much younger wife with my
prototype?
Not laptop.
Is that a typewriter?
What was before laptop? I can't even think of my own invention here. This was my idea for a notebook.
Oh.
This was a notebook.
Oh, fantastic.
That went on to be a laptop. That's my wife back in the 70s. Now, this was because I'm left-handed and I had this terrible time with taking notes in the college dorms or in the rooms where the place the right's over on the right-hand side.
Yes.
So my idea was to have all the students have one of these with them and simply type as the professor talked, and it would scroll across here and then be stored. You see, and then you'd take it back to your room.
Yes.
And you would download it from what was stored, and you could hear the professor's words again.
Right.
Well, in those days, the analog it was a great idea, but in those days it was the days of the analog as opposed to what is it now, Patrick?
Digital.
Right. And it didn't have the horsepower
right.
with it, and
right.
so it sort of died of its own advancements or something like that. But
what was the storage medium? What did you store it on? What did
it
write to?
It would have been like on a disk,
like a floppy disk, or
yeah,
something
like
that.
Like we had used up in Alaska on the ballistic missile early system I worked on there. To run the radars there in the ballistic missile early warning system, it took enough electricity to supply a city of 70,000 people.
To operate that one missile system?
Well, that one site of the BMU system.
Wow.
We had three radars watching out over Russia there. The floors were this thick, full of wires and cables and everything. And the power going out there, you know what a waveguide is?
Mm-mm.
I mean, the power was so powerful that wires won't handle it. So a waveguide is a square, like a square metal tunnel like that.
Sure.
And in the middle of that is where the power is going. And because of the, you know, magnet attraction and this and that, you could have that power going to the radars through the middle. Wires wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So by waveguides. So, but it's 70,000 people in the power plant there.
Wow.
And it was right near, fortunately, a coal mine there in Alaska. So anyway, it's all changed now. So
yes.
So
that's a great shot, though.
that's kind of a joke at this point. But it was a my wife had worked in Florida and in those days they stored their stuff on those big discs. Maybe you've seen them, Patrick,
mm-hmm.
big things like that. She had to store everything at the end of her shift,
right.
And so the next morning she'd have to take it out of there and put it back into her computer.
Sure.
And that gave me the idea of having this thing into a disc. Not nearly as big as hers, but still the same idea.
Right.
And then take it back to your room and.
And did you have a patent on that?
Yeah.
Did you have a patent on your notebook?
No, I started to, I considered it, but
yeah.
Like I say, it didn't have the technology at the time. It would have been huge. I mean, what it would have taken with that kind of technology would have filled a room too.
Yeah, my goodness.
So it was just a little bit of an idea ahead of its time. But
did you talk about your advocacy? Did that? Did you start working on this aspect of your work alongside of your professional life, or did it really come into play after you retired?
The aeronautical stuff all went hand in hand with my working every day for RCA, or at the time, I guess I was with BP. I was with BP, let me think here. No, it was with RCA at Clear Alaska that this idea came at Christmas time, 1 year after my
So when you were after
conversion.
Yeah. So you would have been around 39 or
39 years old. and then so I just went on from there. As I say, flew all the way to Langley Field and talked to the head of what's now NASA. It was called NACA in those days, and he actually was involved in a project which was a terribly bad idea. He let a fellow by the name of Amos Jones push supposedly a supersonic idea, which would never have worked.
Right.
But it also infringed on my patent if it had worked, but it wouldn't have worked anyway. And it was to fly a airplane supersonically, like this for slow flight, and then like that for speed flight.
Closing the scissor action.
Yeah, and it was in all the newspapers and everything about this thing, but it died of its own stupidity.
Right.
Because the moment, the flex moment out here, supersonically, that you couldn't fly the wingtips supersonically without them disintegrating. It was a bum idea and it never went anywhere.
Yeah.
Another one that I have a copyrighted article against was this wind shear thing. I don't know if you were in the States at the time. You probably weren't old enough, but there was a time when the government was proposing to have wind shear detectors all over the United States, detecting wind shear so that airplanes wouldn't crash when they flew into them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tremendous expensive
mm-hmm.
problem or project, and it wouldn't have done the job. And so I copyrighted an article. I drove my car going to work in Washington, D.C. Around, and I had in the back window fear flying, fear dying. If you do, call this number. Well, nobody called me, so I copyrighted this article saying what was wrong with this whole thing. And it too died.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Take me back a little bit to your family life. You and what year did you get married?
We were married April 15th, 1949, I think.
And what was Muriel? What was her maiden name?
Her name was Wright, Muriel Wright, and I was discharged July 3rd, 1946,
mm-hmm.
and went off to college, and there she was. So we've more or less been not together in the way they talk about it now, but we dated and so forth, went through all that stuff, and then married now 61 years, April 15th. Might be 62 years next April.
Yeah, my goodness. And you have family?
We have four children, girls. I'm sorry, three girls and a boy. The oldest girl is here in Missoula,
mm-hmm.
up to the rattlesnake there.
Right.
The second girl we lived on a farm with out in Lone Pine after my retirement from the Navy,
mm-hmm.
From 1990 until this last March when my wife's health was such that we moved
to town. Yeah.
And the third daughter was happened to be delivered by the mayor of Fairbanks. In those days the professional people in Anchorage, Fairbanks passed the mayor's job around.
Yes.
To the professional people, and the only obstetrician in town became the mayor.
Fantastic.
Also delivered our daughter.
Great.
We flew her home from in a light plane from Fairbanks out to Clear Air Force Station.
Yeah.
And then the boy was born the year before. I went to Alaska by myself the first year.
Mm-hmm.
I had traveled to the United States recruiting engineers and technicians to go on VMUs, which was the biggest defense effort of the free world at the time. If you don't know about VMUs, ballistic missile early warning system.
Okay.
They called it, the strategy was mutually assured destruction. If they sent bombers, we would send, I mean, if they sent missiles, we'd send bombers and we'd have World War III.
Yes.
So, I flew all over the United States recruiting engineers and technicians to go up there.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, talked myself into it.
Uh-oh.
So, Muriel said, I was going, she wasn't. So I went the first year by myself.
Yeah.
And she joined me.
With three children, or you had your third child born there?
Mark was born in Bradford, PA, back in, we bought a house back in her hometown,
mm-hmm.
where she went to live in the same town with her parents, and our boy was born in Bradford. I managed to be able to be down on sort of a leave.
Yes.
Gave him his first bottle, got on back. Got on the plane and back to Alaska. He's well placed with FedEx now, a computer guy.
Right. And how long did the family live in Alaska?
9.5 years altogether. I did.
Yes. My goodness.
Something else I might slip in there professionally. Sounds like a lot of bragging. I took that degree in psychology. It worked well,
yes,
in labor relations, and I finished out my, you might say, career, my vocation, having been appointed by Admiral Hernandez in Washington, D.C. to be the chief negotiator between the Navy and its unionized employees, civilian employees.
Congratulations.
So, I don't know what it calls for that or
yeah.
condolences, but I managed to get the government sued by one of the unions we won the suit, incidentally. The negotiations got so tense that I, what would they call that, malpractice suit or something like that, and they lost. I mean they didn't, but anyway, it was pretty tense, and that's when the stress of that sort of thing began my physical problems with PAT, paroxysmal atrial tachycardia.
Right.
And I've been hospitalized probably 12 times with that. So.
Yeah, sounds like a very stressful position you got appointed
well,
to.
Well, I have to watch it. It's one of those things, you know.
Yeah.
When you get old, you have something.
Absolutely. So, obviously, you've done some research, as you say, through your connections with the LDS and so forth. But one of the questions we've been asking people as part of this process is, how much of a sense of your Irish heritage has been part of your life, professional life and personal life?
Actually, to tell you the truth, not that much. I was pleased to know from my LDS cousin that that we came from Ireland. It sounds like a warm, beautiful place.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd sure like to go back there, and that I am very much in agreement with the underdog in situations. You know, I'm not a big fan of the way England or the British government treated anybody.
Yes.
Especially, well, the Irish and Indians and whoever, you know,
yeah.
This whole colonialization thing that they did. I just don't agree with the royalty at all.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of the movies such as that I've seen here recently about the rebellion, you know, by the Irish there against maltreatment. And I've heard about them, you know, getting people in their huts and then bulldozing the darn huts and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And to be on the, what I call the right side of that, has been really encouraging to me to find out I was come from Carniara.
Yeah, yeah.
and probably way on back before that, actually. Calvert means, in French, was calf herders.
Right.
Back in the Middle Ages, when you took a name, you took a name based on what your occupation was, and
yeah.
We were Norman calf herders,
right.
Which became Calvert, and then Calvert, so forth. But
yeah.
I'm glad we got smart, and at least some of us got smart and left England and left to Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, the you mentioned earlier about having an Orange heritage, the complexities of that history are really fascinating.
Yeah.
They really are. I lived in Northern Ireland for some time.
I'm sorry?
I lived in Northern Ireland for some time.
Thought you might.
Just loved it up there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I guess my final question might then be moot, but you've moved to Montana, obviously. Was it when you came to live with your daughter? Is that when you moved to Montana, or were you living in Montana before then?
My oldest daughter came to live with us in Anchorage and went to work in a bank,
mm-hmm.
and a Norwegian fellow from Norwegian heritage came up there to work in the bank in the summertime while he was a student here at the university.
Right.
Gary Wanberg, Norwegian. And when he walked in the bank, my daughter's girlfriend says, "There he is."
Right, yeah.
And it turned out to be that way. And so they were married in Anchorage. And of course, she's now a grandmother.
Oh.
And that's what brought us to Montana was when I had retired from the Navy April 30th, 1990,
mm-hmm.
after I finished that big contract I was telling you about, I said goodbye to the Navy. And I went to Alaska to get the the second daughter and her husband, who were having a hard time farming up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we came down here and to sort of gather all together in Billings.
Yes.
Where Gary and Beth were. He
mm-hmm.
was the FBI in Billings. But my second daughter's husband had ideas about our settling in Sanders County,
mm-hmm.
where some of his relatives were. So, make that long story short, we ended up in Sanders County for 20 years.
Right.
In a 40-acre farm out there. And I second daughter loves horses, so
oh,
she's
great.
Just
yeah, yeah. So you've been in Missoula here just for a year or so, you said?
Just April, March 15th we moved in here.
Right.
But it's only 80 miles out to where we did a lot of shopping here, because our oldest daughter, he retired and came home to be with his mom, still lives here.
Yes.
So we could have gone to Kalispell, but we just didn't. We've been coming to Missoula for 20 years now.
Yeah. Montana obviously has a very wide and varied history, as indeed does the States, but the Irish are very much part of that history, and even though I know you mentioned you yourself haven't felt much of an influence of your Irish heritage on your own life, having lived in Montana, could you comment on what you think might be the Irish, the significance of the Irish history on Montana, or the presence of the Irish in Montana?
Well, I think there's a direct connection with where people who have a close connection with Northern Ireland and the free spirit out here, the do-it-yourself, get it done type of ranchers and not wait for somebody else to come along and
yes.
and feed you. I mean, go get it.
Yeah.
My original name I changed from Havilah, which is in the I think it's in the second chapter of Genesis in the Bible, and it talks about a land that is watered by the river Pishon, which flows out of the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm.
and it talks about there being gold and precious stones there, but the whole idea is they're there. But they're buried. I mean, you got to do something. See?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sitting around waiting for them to pop out of the ground into your pocket.
Yes.
And everybody I meet out here seems to have gotten a hold of the same idea that to have a hold of adversity and turn it around.
Turn it around.
Yeah.
That is a unique answer to that question, and I like it a lot.
Well, it's different. I have to admit, I don't have that. I was never a. I wasn't a farmer till I was 50. When did I retire? 57 years old.
Right.
And business suit, tie, and all that, and
yeah.
I came out here, and started moving irrigation pipe.
No need for the tie then.
What have I got into? You know, with the mosquitoes, you know.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
I have not.
He has. As soon as you get the pipe up, they wait, you know, the mosquitoes wait for you until you get the pipe up in the air like this.
Yeah.
Then they line up across the back of your neck and they all wait and bite you once. You know, they did the same thing in Alaska, flying.
Yeah?
Yeah, when you're gassing, you pour gas out of a 20-gallon can into an airplane wing.
Yeah.
They just sit there and wait till you're up there and pour in the gas and then nail you.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
so anyway.
Thank you so much, Gillen. I wonder if you could show us, you mentioned a photograph of the plane that you flew.
The one from Alaska to
yeah.
Sure.
Let's take a look at that.
Yeah, do you want me to stay here or
no.
Want me to stay at Bernadette?
Bernadette, yes.
Yeah, probably do that. Respecting that sort of thing. But I have 500 or 600 pictures in my computer.
Yes.
That might be of some interest. But this is a Balanca, which was just like equivalent of a beach craft right here. It's a 260 Balanca 260.
Mm-hmm.
And I was flying from Fairbanks or Anchorage to Washington D.C. and to Florida, and this is my wife.
Yes.
There were five of us in a four-place airplane.
Uh-oh.
Not the greatest idea. This is her dad and her mom. My wife, then. This is the gal that, now she's a grandmother that lives in Lone Pine, loves horses. This is Julie, and she has four. Mark has five, this fella here.
Yes.
And we landed in Bradford, Pennsylvania on the way to Florida to see her folks. And this, that was the pride, joy, this Belenka.
I'm sure.
Beautiful red, white, and blue.
Yeah.
And
was it your role?
Yes, I mean in partnership with another fellow. He's still alive out in Washington.
My goodness.
But it was really fun.
I'm sure.
And then we had landed in Ohio, where I had used to work for people there and took some of them for rides.
Yes.
And then on over to Bradford. The day this picture, we were loading up to go on to Florida here,
mm-hmm.
and the picture was taken there.
Take a snapshot of this.
Here's the Northrop Grumman. Here's the Northrop Grumman picture out of their patent application.
Oh yeah.
Let me see that. That's the Northrop Grumman idea.
Right.
And as I had shown the Missoulian photographer, you see this.
Yep.
See that it's the same thing. They started out with wings like this for slow flight,
yep.
takeoff and landing, and then they swung that wing clear around into that notch there.
Yep.
And
for supersonic
made it
flight.
Supersonic. And I had this. Well, what was the date of this thing?
This
is 2003. Patented this in
1971.
Yeah. So anyway, I just put some stuff together here. This I thought this was fascinating that you somehow got an oil plate. Yeah,
well, this is a Gallus frame from Butte.
Huh?
That's a Gallus frame for the hoists for the mines.
Oh, that's not
oil, no.
It looks very much like those old.
They're constructed really similarly.
Wooden towers.
Yep,
yeah.
Oil derricks.
Yeah.
I have a picture someplace of where you can walk from one to another. I told you about.
Yeah.
So.
Beautiful.
Do you want any physical? Any files? Are you doing anything like this with any filing?
Yeah, well, we are keeping a file on each
participant. Could I just give you this? Would you?
Oh, I would be thrilled to have it.
Here's.
Of course, I'll need you to sign another form for me.
Sure. here's total projects listing. This was a couple of years ago when we were going to buy property out in Hot Springs.
Yes.
And this didn't apply. I mean, the fuel storage, the vehicle maintenance, those things wouldn't apply now. But this you might be interested in. What I'm doing now, the French, let me tell you off the record just a minute.
Oh,
sure.
Off the record, let me turn this off then.